Good morning. Thank you all for being here. I have the distinction, along with Raul, of having been assigned the topic by Frank de la Teja. When I was assigned this topic, I couldn't believe my good fortune, A, because I had done a little bit of research on Ramon Muskis, and B, because, as I will try to argue today, he is the preeminent politician of Mexican Texas, and he left the political crumbs to others like Seguin and the other Navarros and the other things, even though I may come in for a hard time in this crowd for this. It is easy to feel sympathetic toward those hardy Mexican Texans whose only guilt was to have lived through a tumultuous era of wars and revolutions. Life was heavy-handed to them. But at least we can learn from their existence. Ramon Muskis was one such tortured soul. Like his contemporaries, Muskis possessed the ability to survive and even thrive in a difficult frontier environment. But unlike most of his peers, Don Ramon retained a sense of fairness and proportion, even as Texas descended into bitter partisan politics, ethnic strife, and ultimately all-out war. He was eagerly sought the same by political allies than rivals, by business partners than competitors, by Mexicans than foreigners. He remained in good stead with most everyone that he had occasion to meet, and thus became the ultimate insider in an exceedingly fractious world. And for this reason alone, Ramon Muskis' biography remains as relevant today as it did nearly two centuries ago. Could we get this is the image of Ramon Muskis. Ramon Muskis belonged to one of the most prominent families of explorers and settlers in the entire North East of New Spain. He could trace his lineage back to José Antonio de Cay Muskis, one of the founders of the city of Monclova, Coahuila. More than a century later, the family still thrived in that area. Ramon was born in 1797 in the town and presidio of Santa Rosa in the municipality of Monclova. Could we get the next one? It's down here. You can see it on your lower left hand side corner, right by the legend little square. You can see Santa Rosa and Monclova on the other side. To get a sense of his early circumstances and his enormous privilege, suffice it to say that his birthplace, which also functioned as the clan's ancestral home, would be later renamed Muskis, or Melchor Muskis, in the memory of another family member who briefly occupied the presidency of Mexico during 1832. Here is the man. So Ramon's father, Lieutenant Miguel Francisco Muskis, was a prominent member of this clan. And in fact, by the end of the 18th century, Lieutenant Muskis was presidial commander of Santa Rosa. And this is now, you know, the way the city was renamed afterwards. Could we get the next one, please? In 1800, when Ramon was still a toddler, Lieutenant Muskis was dispatched to Nacogdoches to take command of the military post there. At that time, Nacogdoches was the remotest Mexican town in Texas and easily the most exposed to the advancing wave of foreign settlers. It also lay along a crucial corridor employed by various indigenous and non-indigenous groups engaged in the horse trade between Texas and Louisiana. In short, Nacogdoches showcased all the perils, but also all the opportunities that Texas had to offer at that time. And Ramon's father was in the middle of it all. Lieutenant Muskis regularly visited Indian camps and confronted peripatetic individuals harboring all kinds of schemes. His greatest claim to fame was the capture of Philip Nolan. Could we get the next one? In 1801. It's a fascinating story, but we don't have time to go there right now. The Muskis family must have possessed a distinct sense of noblesse oblige and patriotism, that is, Mexican patriotism or Spanish patriotism. Yet the unruly frontier also offered some avenues of advancement that Lieutenant Muskis did not overlook. His responsibilities as military commander did not prevent him from becoming involved in some commercial ventures. And in fact, he was accused of contraband trade at Goliad in those early years. In 1804, Lieutenant Muskis was ordered to go back to Coahuila along with his 100-man detachment. And that could have been the end of his association with Texas, but by then his ties were very strongly cemented. So from his base in Coahuila, he continued to have relations with all kinds of Texans, and in fact, he served as presidial commander of San Antonio in 1806. For the younger Muskis, for Ramon, these years must have constituted an invaluable apprenticeship of everything that would be important in his life, from the character of Indians and Anglo-Americans to the intricacies of the imperial bureaucracy to the astonishing profits that could be made by the sheer buying and selling of goods. In his tender youth, Ramon must have decided that the military life was definitely not for him. But he did follow his father's footsteps in one crucial regard. They both built their lives around the linkages between Coahuila and Texas. And thus, in the twilight years of the Spanish rule, Ramon launched his career in the civilian world as postmaster of the city of Monclova, overseeing regular mail deliveries between Monclova and San Antonio. Mexico's independence from Spain brought several novelties to the frontier, chief among them the easing of trading restrictions with the United States. Now, the opportunities for young, entrepreneurial, and well-placed individuals like Muskis must have been endless. Can we get the next one? Muskis started out his colonial predecessors by taking goods from Monclova into San Antonio. Already in 1823, he was importing 58 cargas, including such profitable articles as wine and aguardiente. But soon enough, Muskis made the transition to the more profitable trade with the United States, and he regularly made trips to New Orleans and came back carried with all these material goods that had so much demand in Texas. All told, he became one of the most successful Mexican merchants to be found anywhere in Texas. However, just as Muskis himself consolidated his building, his network, and operating the store in San Antonio, duty called. In May 1825, he was named secretary of the ailing jefe político of Texas, José Antonio Saucedo. Why choose a relative newcomer like Muskis to occupy this very crucial post of secretary? It is difficult to know for sure. For starters, Chief Saucedo was already well acquainted with Ramon's father when they both coincided in San Antonio back in 1806. Saucedo as alcalde and Lieutenant Muskis as commander and presidial troops. And I even have found a court case where they both coincide. So they definitely knew each other very well. So Saucedo, this aging leader, must have become persuaded that the connections of the Muskis family to Coahuila would serve Texas well. And it also helped that Ramon had revealed himself as a prospering businessman. So he decided to appoint him as his secretary. For Ramon himself, this appointment was a mixed bag. It was a definite mixed bag. And it's a current theme that we have been seeing in some of the other papers, that is, none of these Tejanos really wanted to hold office. It's a problem. On the one hand, his appointment as secretary confirmed his social and political standing in Texas, and that was really good. But on the other hand, this would really put some difficulties in his booming business. Above all, he would lack mobility, because every time he had to leave Coahuila to go to Louisiana, he would have to actually ask for permission, a process that would take weeks or even months, something that would be absolutely devastating in a fast-moving business like the commercial world that he operated in. Moreover, and again, it's a theme that has been developed earlier, there was not enough money in the office to buy supplies, etc. So finally, he decided to extricate himself and resigned as secretary. Yet, the transplanted Coahuilan was not allowed to walk away so easily. And instead, he was entrusted with even greater responsibility. Before 1827 was out, Musquiz was named jefe político, political chief of Texas, as was very ably explained by Raúl earlier, the functioning governor of Texas, and would remain in this post. He never looked back. Would remain in this post essentially until 1834, 1835. He is the Tejano governor of Texas during the Mexican period. But Musquiz also found this exalted position also a mixed bag. He did learn to juggle public office and private business in advantageous ways. It would be called conflict of interest today, but the notion did not exist back in the 1820s. Musquiz, for example, had military escorts accompany his wagons full of merchandise as they moved from Goliad to San Antonio. He also petitioned for 11 sitios of land by the Trinity River, and while the land granting process was largely beyond his hands, he must have been aware that his investiture tilted the odds decidedly in his favor. But of course, not all were advantages. In times of necessity, Mexico's government called on its most favored children. And this is what happened to Musquiz at the end of 1829, when he was asked to loan 3,482 pesos, again, an enormous sum, for the upkeep of the Texas military. And so as he was finding out, Musquiz was finding out the Mexican government was a vast patronage network in which monies moved back and forth, sometimes to your advantage, sometimes not. Don Ramon's first term as jefe político was exceedingly successful, so much so that when the time came to choose a successor in 1830, the Tejano political elite, perennial ayuntamiento members such as the Navarros, the Seguins, the Veramendis, the Casianos, did not hesitate to nominate Musquiz again. An electoral commission had to propose a list of three candidates, and Musquiz's name topped the list. The commission's endorsement even hinted that Musquiz could stay on indefinitely, and this is what they had to say. Isn't it a constitutional mania to change one political chief by another just to satisfy a certain longing for novelty? The electoral commissioners asked with obvious intention. He held the jefatura until July of 1834. Now, why did the Tejano elite throw its lot so solidly behind Musquiz, again, a relative newcomer? Once again, it is difficult to say for certain, but we have some clues. Virtually all influential Tejanos who had a say in the reappointment of Musquiz were active participants in the Louisiana-Texas trade. And so as one of the most successful merchants of San Antonio, Musquiz emerges an inspiring example, a valuable partner, and a leader willing to keep the door between Mexico and the United States wide open. So this is one thing. Musquiz also appears to have been able to please his Tejano allies in matters of land distribution. He worked effectively with ayuntamiento members and state authorities to make available enormous tracts of land in and around the San Antonio Goliad area. The lands from the recently secularized missions were especially appealing because, as Musquiz himself would later explain, the fathers had vast knowledge of the advantages offered by the land on which they choose to build their missions. End of quote. Beyond the decided support of fellow Tejanos, Musquiz also enjoyed considerable favor amongst Anglo-Texan settlers. Musquiz's support for Anglo-American colonization is most poignant and evident in the controversial role that he played with regard to the issue of slavery. Can we get the next one? The next one. On September 15, 1829, on the anniversary of Mexico's independence from Spain, President Vicente Guerrero decreed the abolition of slavery. The decree was laconic and unambiguous. Article 1, slavery is hereby abolished. Article 2, everyone who thus far has been considered a slave is now free. Article 3, former slave owners will be compensated according to the corresponding laws and as circumstances permit, which, of course, in the circumstances is probably never, right? So that was the situation. So Guerrero was the second president elected under the Constitution of 1824, an ardent liberal, and a mulatto veteran of the Wars of Independence. and his unexpected decree caused commotion throughout Texas. Muskies had long been acquainted with the peculiar institution. In fact, and this was interesting when I started digging up on this, he had grown up in a household with slaves. They would go to Nuevo León to purchase some of these slaves, and so his whole childhood was with slaves until he was about the age of 9 at least. Moreover, as a well-informed jefe político, Muskies was well aware of the vital role played by slave labor in the Anglo-American colonies. The cotton plantations and the cattle ranches stood to suffer a devastating blow with the Emancipation Decree. So Muskies learned about President Guerrero's decree in a letter from the governor of Coahuila and Texas on October 16, 1829. He had a difficult choice to make. And after consulting with some of his friends, the Seguins and the Navarros, etc., he decided to suspend publication of the decree. In the meantime, he would urge President Guerrero to grant Texas an exception. The case Muskies made in favor of slavery is meticulous and quite instructive. He noted, for example, that Stephen F. Austin's first colonist had been specifically granted the right to hold slaves. And so the Emancipation Decree would be breaking a solemn promise that had been made to the colonists originally. He also pointed out that these unfortunate men and women had already been enslaved before arriving into Mexico. And thus, and I quote him, "While philanthropy and the natural sympathies of humanity cry out in favor of liberty, the positive laws which regulate society take the side of property and declare it a sacred right." Okay, so very legalistic kind of... And finally, Muskies concluded that the publication of the Emancipation Decree would just bring about commotion throughout Texas. And so he essentially put his work on the line in order to get this emancipation rescinded. And by December of 1829, he succeeded and Texas was granted an exemption. None of this means that the jefe político was a mindless supporter of Tejano and Anglo-American interests. Above all, Muskies was a Mexican nationalist. And here is probably the key to understanding why he was such a successful insider into both sides, into all of the sides. His chief aim as jefe político was to develop Texas as a part of the Mexican nation. And yet, by the early 1830s, the profound Anglo-Americanization of Texas had put this vision into question. Don Ramon seemed especially concerned about the lack of respect for Mexican laws prevalent in the colonies. The signs were plain to see. Starting in 1830, many Anglo-American merchants chose to defy Mexico's tariff regulations. Vessels bound for the colony simply refused to clear customs, ran the blockades, and even traded fire with Mexican soldiers garrisoned at Anahuac and Velasco. Foreign-born colonists also seemed very oblivious to any restrictions on slavery. Even though Ramon Muskies had been a conspicuous proponent of slavery, as we just saw, he was incensed in May of 1832 when he learned that a posse of 7 Anglo-Americans from Austin's and the Witts colonies had entered San Antonio to apprehend 4 adult slaves and a boy. The crime committed by Henrik Brown and his accomplices is of such a nature and scope, wrote an irate Muskies, that it tramples over the laws of a hospitable country that has received them in her bosom, regarding them as adoptive sons, and they return the favor by making a mockery out of the authorities charged with preserving the security of this town and of the entire department. End of quote. How many? 2? 3? Perfect. A flashpoint of Anglo-American disregard for Mexican laws occurred during the conventionist movement of 1832-33. The jefe político was caught in the middle in this controversy. He could not endorse a procedure that so patently disregarded his authority, but at the same time, he tried to build common ground with the Anglo-American colonies, telling them that, in fact, the purposes that they advocated were the ones that he himself was pursuing. During much of 1834 33, 34, and 35, Muskis withdrew from public office. There were several reasons for this. He was battling an illness. Some of his friends, like Beramendis, died in the cholera epidemic of 1833, and some other family members, possibly. And he finally re-emerged in 1835 during that turmoil in which a centralism was gaining ground in Mexico and a staunchly federalist administration was organized. Can we get the next one? Under Agustin Viesca in Coahuila and Texas. And Muskis was appointed vice-governor of that. But he seemed he was withdrawing from political office. He instead went to New Orleans on a very extended trip, which is very interesting, but again, fitting with some of the ideas there that have been presented. He really didn't want to get involved in politics at this point. I would like to conclude by saying that Muskis crossed the Texas firmament briefly but brightly after the Battle of the Alamo. He was there to identify some of the bodies, and he remained in San Antonio for a few more weeks. And after that, he decided to retire to Coahuila, where he lived the rest of his life. He lost most everything in the Texas Revolution. His shipment that he had worth maybe 30,000 pesos was completely lost. It was seized by the centralist authorities. His house in the plaza was given to Erastus Deaf Smith as recompense for his participation in the Mexican Revolution. And so even though his rise to prominence was meteoric, so had been his demise. Noblesse oblige. He became entangled in Mexico's endless revolutions, as he put it, fighting against the oligarchs who supported the Constitution of 1836 and in favor of those who wished to reestablish that of 1824. It was a struggle that would not end within his lifetime. Thank you so much.